Wednesday, May 23rd, 2007, before Representative Greenlee's complaints continue to a dull roar. And that would be a very dull roar indeed. We have several items on our agenda this afternoon, members. Senator Schroeder, do you want a little bit more time to look that over?
I'm okay, sir.
Okay, very good. I'm going to open up a work session then on Senate Bill 336. And I'd like to ask our fast-moving committee administrator to remind us what Senate Bill 336 is all about, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 336 removes the provision providing that school capacity cannot be the sole basis for approval or denial of a residential development application unless the application involves changes to a local government comprehensive plan or land use regulations. The committee has before it a -1 amendment, which would replace high-growth school district with the term large school district. Define a large school district as one with enrollment over 2,500 students. Modify the language regarding school facility planning with the city or county. Extend the length of the school facility plan from 5 years to 10 years. Modify the language describing what a large school district may do in the school facility plan. Delete language that would limit when a city or county would be required to provide notice to an affected school district when considering a plan or land use regulation amendment that significantly impacts school capacity. Direct that, quote, a residential development application may be denied based on a lack of school capacity if A, the issue is raised by the school district, B, the lack of school capacity is based on an adopted school facility plan pursuant to Section 7 of this 2007 Act, and C, the local government has considered other options to address school capacity. And finally, the amendment would direct that a large school district shall complete a school facility plan within 2 years after the effective date of this 2007 Act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senator Schroeder, would you like to join us? We also have our legislative counsel.
Somewhere else, I think.
Person here, if needed. She's trying to get out of the room, apparently. Okay. Welcome back, Senator Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kurt Schroeder, Senate District 20, and have worked with some of the people interested in this particular bill and trying to draft some amendments that are consensus-based, and hopefully others will agree. I personally am okay with the amendments. The dash ones that have been brought to you, I think, today here just a few moments ago.
Yeah,
particular concern to me would be on page 6, just above section 2, lines 9 through 15, where basically the heart of the original bill that I submitted, if you recall. I like the proactive language that 13 now has in it. I think having the issue raised by a school district's fair, and all planning applications seek input from school districts and other public facilities. I think it's fair that a school should have some sort of capital plan upon which they're asking for assistance. That makes sense. The last C, we had trouble trying to draw that language. The goal, I think, behind that, and others can correct me if I state it, were to make sure that the city or county or the developer, if you will, had an opportunity to change their application so there wouldn't be such a big impact on the school district and therefore it could go forward. That was, I think, the intent of that. Maybe we've not hit the perfect language, but there may be another opportunity. Since this is being amended as we speak, we'll have to go back over the Senate side. We have to refine that language. But that's the intent of C, as I understood it, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I think it's good public policy.
Thank you, Senator. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Roland.
Representative Schroeder, we hardly ever get a non-A engrossed bill, and now we're changing that. Instead, I thought you had the perfect bill before we had to do this.
Well, I thought it was pretty perfect, too, sir. But it's in the eye.
That's the only reason I'm opposed to it.
The difference between a perfect bill and perfect power.
Can I
ask a question?
Representative Greenlee.
Is this does this put undue requirements on a school district?
That section, I think, is not at all. When I was a planning commissioner, I think most planning jurisdictions, when you have a development application before you, request input from all the public facility providers for comment as to whether or not they have adequate capacity to handle the new development. And in my jurisdiction anyway, and in the Clackamas County, they would just write back, check a box, yes or no, and why, and so it should not be difficult at all.
Representative Roeber.
Thank you. So this really puts schools in about the same place that it does with respect to cities on their sewer if they, or water district or those,
yes.
Because in each of those cases, they ask the same kinds of questions.
Yes.
They just haven't always asked the school districts or whatever. So it really puts them in the same stead.
I think it's, I'm sorry to interrupt, that's it. Representative, Mr. Chair, but yeah, I think this is a much better position for them to be in.
Representative Dolan.
No, I did have a question, but I think the bill is sound. I was going to ask the senator, if we had a large development coming, this would simply say that the school couldn't yay or nay the development, but could begin to plan for it. And that seems like the way it should be.
Yeah, if the development was, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, large enough to overwhelm the capacity of the school and the superintendent's opinion, and they could then, the planning commission or the city council could deny that particular development. Or, as in this bill here under Section C, modify that development so that it did not overwhelm the capacity of the school and the development would go forward. That's the way I read this. So it's fairly flexible, actually.
Mr. Chair.
President Greenland.
Yeah, the question I was referring to is it's on page six of the amendments, and line 12 on down. It's the lack of school capacity is based on a school facility plan formally adopted under Section 7. It was the development of that school facility plan that
that would be, Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be an added cost if they have not already done that. But in my opinion,
but not an unreasonable thing to be doing.
I don't think it's unreasonable at all. No, sir. There are jurisdictions that perhaps have not done that, but if we're going to ask that they have the capability and responsibility of being able to say yes or no to an application, they would have a good reason for doing it. You have to have a capital plan to be able to do that, in my opinion, sir.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Roeber.
More of just a comment. You know, come from relatively small districts that would not be affected necessarily, but they have always had a facilities group, a subcommittee that was always working, and they've always had a plan because they always either had to know where the property was going to be or if they were going to sell property that they had to do other kinds of things for facilities. So I would hope every district does that if they're looking ahead at all. Declining or growing districts have to keep looking at where their facilities are. I think most of them do.
Thank you, Representative. Members, further questions of the senator? Well, thank him for his time.
Thank you very much for your consideration.
Was there anyone else who would want to weigh in on the Dash 1 amendments? Mr. Chandler, would that come forward? You can.
Yeah, you got five votes. You want to go for four?
Welcome, Mr. Chairman.
I'm the chairman member of the committee, John Chandler, the bank for the Oregon Home Builders Association. Thank you for your time. I actually wanted to try to address your question, Representative Greenlee, in that much of this bill is existing law. And the particular requirement that you flagged of requiring school districts to do a plan, they've been supposed to do that since 1991. Not a lot have, and frankly, that's part of the problem that we've encountered with this bill over the years. Senator Schrader and I have had a rolling argument on this issue for quite some time. I think it's because of this session with 1036 moving, the excise tax bill, which will be in front of you on the floor here shortly, the renewed interest in doing something about the faster-growing school districts made us look back at the law that's been on the books for quite a while to see if there's a way to beef it up and improve it. We broadened it out not just to the high-growth districts like Beaverton but to others, but also put in some more requirements. The one you flagged, though, Representative, has been there. And the school districts, I think, should be doing that planning, hopefully with this new language to encourage them to do so. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and we just saw these amendments as well, on page 6, line 13 of the Dash 1s, this is the language that Senator Schrader spent a lot of time talking about in his testimony, where it says the lack of school capacity is based on a school facility plan formally adopted under subsection 7. I believe that's the wrong cross-reference.
7's gone, though.
Yeah, I think the one that they were referring to was old 7, and I don't think we can refer to old 7. So that's
9, maybe?
I'm doing this in my...
We have
I think it's subsection 5, actually. Subsection 5 describes what the school facility plan must include, and that it should be, goes into all the alternatives, the analysis they're supposed to do. So I think that would actually be the subsection. Mr. Chairman, members, when this bill was being amended, we did a couple things. We added some new provisions, such as changing high growth to large, changing 5,000 to 2,500, putting in the new language in, that Senator Schrader was talking about. We also reorganized the section so it actually read better. It hadn't been. I know, that was a mistake right there. And I think when we did that, reorganized for clarity, we managed to...
As concrete sequential people, it's like you tip this upside down.
Quite so.
Chairman, I'm going to let Mr. Olson make a clarification here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can double-check with Legislative Council, but I believe that that reference, like subsection 7, is something that can be cleaned up when the bill is engrossed and would not require a further amendment. So I think if the committee were interested in adopting this amendment today, I think it could without any problems, but I will double-check with LC.
Thank you, Mr.
Earlier, just take a conceptual amendment to change
it. Earlier today, we did that in another bill on rules, and I think that conceptual amendment just to make it 7 is fine as well.
Very good.
Okay. I would ask Mr. Chandler, as I look down the dais, a lot of schools don't have a plan. That's constant. When you deal with school districts, what percentage don't have a plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, I would reverse the question. I would like to know which ones do. In terms of long-range facility planning, at least in the areas where I get, my industry has been sideways with school districts, it has been those that did not. By the way, there's no value judgment there. I think
we were under the assumption that
everybody did it.
Well, apparently not.
One of the things I think we ran into, this is going back many years, Mr. Chairman, was that the role of schools and the people who are employed, the educators in the school districts, tends not to be municipal planners. They tend not to be land use boss. They tend not to be developers. And so the planning that's done may well be defined as that goes, as it relates to the local government, oftentimes those disconnects. And what we're hoping with this bill is that the cities and counties and school districts will play nicely together, coordinate their planning so that the city is going to grow north by northwest, the school starts thinking about acquiring land, planning their facilities north by northwest. So there's more conversations happening and fewer surprises when developers or residents find out that there's portable showing up or something of the sort.
Vice Chair Conlon.
This is just my perception on this also, and Mr. Chandler, ever since Measure 5, districts have been very vigilant about making sure they have long-range plans for their facilities because, boy, if you're going to try to pass a bond, you could better have plenty of planning behind you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Dahlem.
The good bill should pass. I think the plan. Maybe these are secret plans, but they're not much good if you don't share them with anybody. But
would you care to join us?
If you don't mind. For the record, Dana Hepper, Stanford Children, and my understanding is that school districts do put together really solid, comprehensive bond packages when they're going out for a bond, but often outside of a bond, many school districts are not looking at, don't have long-range plannings or don't have long-range plans that are as comprehensive as this is, which I think can improve efficiency when doing long-range planning.
Well, Mr. Chair, things change really fast for some school districts. I sit and watch Beaverton as a school district where you'll have an urban growth boundary increase, and then pretty soon there'll be a proposal to build 800 houses in this area, and there's no place to build a school. And I think they know how many schools they need based on how much growth they have. But the environment that they live in changes so darn fast that in some ways it's very hard to say, well, here's where the next three elementary schools are going to be, which we know we're going to need in the next 3 years and don't have the money to build them yet. And here's where the next two middle schools are going to be, and here's where the next two high schools are going to be. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do.
Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chairman and members, I want to stress that this is not a criticism of school planning at all. It's trying to get at the interrelationship of city and municipal planning so that the city zoning code, the comprehensive plan, incorporates the school plan. And the school plan is done in recognition of where the city is going with its long-range land use planning, rather than have two separate, very well-done plans operating in parallel or, at worst, cross purposes. And this, this has been a tough issue in a lot of jurisdictions. It may not get any easier with the changes we're making. We're hoping that by this, plus, as I said earlier, this and getting some more money in the system, will help encourage the plans to be done and to be followed.
No, I think
very good.
It's not always contiguous with cities.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Exactly right.
Members, any further questions?
You didn't lose any votes.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for your time and efforts on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, we're in a work session, and unless there's someone else who'd like to weigh in, yes, we do have League of Women Voters.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you very much. In spite of the fact that it is a work session, I just wanted to raise a couple of red flags. John is correct. This requirement for a school facilities plan is much more arduous than the kind of school facilities plan that you're talking about, Representative. It has been done. Beaverton and North Clackamas, a number of the school districts have done these plans. It does bring them in, and I do support that part of the process. I have two concerns. One is on page 3, the lines 11 through 14 related to urban growth boundary expansions. I just want to make sure that what I do not want is to have a school sitting just on the edge of a community. So I want to make sure that this language does not allow this little blurb addition of a school on the edge of a UGB, where we really need schools in the centers of their communities. We need them to have walkable schools. We need parents to be nearby, and that is a concern related to this language. So while I certainly want schools to be considered as a part of UGB expansions, and I did hand the administrator and Representative Roblin, because he brought the issue up, the language that is in Metro's regional framework plan that recognizes schools as public facilities specifically, and I'm not certain that this language in this does that specifically. The second part is page 6, the line 11, where it says the issue must be raised by the school district. If, in fact, you are putting schools and school facilities plans on the same level as a water plan or a sewer plan or any other capital plan, then anyone ought to be able to raise the issue that's in the adopted school facilities plan. We do not necessarily have to rely on the school district to do that. And so I would ask, and I want to raise the issue, that it should say the issue is raised by, and it doesn't have to be by the school district, it could be by anyone participating in the process legally. Because sometimes school districts, in their busyness to teach kids, don't get involved in land use, and that's why we've had the problem in the first place. So with those two, I quickly scanned the amendments. And having been a part of the original bill,
right.
I feel some degree of ownership in making it happen better and so that it really works. So I encourage your passage, but I would like to see a couple of minor amendments.
Thank you. Representative Lim.
Yes, if you want to amend amendments, when do you think we can amend this?
Representative, it's my plan. I think we will move this bill today with the committee's approval, and we will have to concur with the Senate, and I'm sure in the conference committee, should we need a conference committee, we can put it together then. And I would hope that you would stay, I'm sure you will, in touch with us on that process.
Thank you, I will.
Would you also like to comment on the dash ones?
Thank you, Representative Buckley, member of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I did have my hand in penning some of this, and just as a comment on Ms. Lynch's comments with concern about that portion that talked about the urban growth boundary, that was in existing statute already. That portion of the bill just got rearranged, so it looks like it's new, but actually it was in the portion of statute dealing with high
Grove school districts.
So that hasn't been changed. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing it to our attention. It's got an all-star cast today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck Bennett representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. To express our support for the bill, we were involved in a work group on this bill during its life. One of the previous speakers regarding the adequate supply of land and schools at the boundaries, that language was essentially in the original bill. This is a reordering of the original bill, so that issue was addressed in the bill that was mentioned. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we would like to place our schools exactly where the children are every time. The problem is the availability of land, and often that's what determines the location of the school. On school facility plans, Ms. Hepper, I think, really accurately described what the situation is out there in terms of plans being developed primarily around bond measures at this point because of a lack of standing, which this will correct and place us right in the middle of the discussion, which is what has us very interested in this bill. I'm trying to remember the percentage off the top of my head. It seems to me, just quickly thinking, that we're talking about 60% of the school districts with declining enrollment. The problem isn't placing schools. It's how do you deal with closing schools and realigning your schools. So many facility plans actually are in retreat rather than in expansion. So it's just a different problem in that case.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Robin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll address this to Chuck, too. I think that the way this bill is written now and what it will do is it may very well give an opportunity for a school district and a big developer to make agreements on part of the land so that they could actually get a good price on the land where the kids are going to go. And before, it was done without them even being consulted, and if there appears that it's going to have too big an impact, they might say, you know, we can develop this, and here's some property we will just deal with the school district and the city to pay at the cost of the deal. And I think that this kind of putting them in that same place at least brings them to the table to have those discussions with people. And I know some developers who would like to do that because it would be an advantage for their place because they want to attract young and whatever families, depending on the kind of development. So I think it just puts people in a place where they're there. And I guess that's what you were saying as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it brings us to the table during that pre-application process and during that early phases of planning to really get us into the mix, but into it with some standing and with an appropriate plan in place. And I think that's really important, that the districts be required to come to the table with something other than population figures, with some real serious discussion and planning of what they have in mind, and makes the whole system more rational if you're going to involve schools in it. I know here in Salem, I serve on the Planning Commission, and we do include schools as a matter of form, but not a matter of substance. I mean, we hear from the schools, but it does, in a way, it just doesn't matter. This will make it matter quite a bit more. And the discussion, I think, will be a lot more fruitful and meaningful.
Pretty quick follow-up?
Real quick follow-up. The other part that I think is really good about this is I think that sometimes school districts get overexcited about a development going in, and then they find out down the road that it was really a retirement center, and it really wasn't a big issue for the school district. They thought there were a lot of houses going, but there weren't going to be any kids there for a long time. So being there at the beginning and really knowing what the process is could be very helpful for districts, because you don't want to start moving all your assets to the place where the people with no kids are going to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ben. Members, we are in work session. I would entertain a motion. Mr. Olson wants to make a clarifying.
I wasn't able to talk to Ramona, but based on what the other members had said and talking briefly with legislative counsel, I believe the appropriate thing is to have a motion to suspend the rules to allow a conceptual amendment to the -1 amendment in which you would correct the site. And we have legislative counsel with us. And then once that was done, there could be a motion to adopt the amended amendment and then to do pass as amended.
Would you care to make that motion?
Yes, I was going to make a motion that we suspend the rules and adopt the conceptual amendment to the Dash One Amendment. What I had in mind all the time.
Okay. Has made a motion to waive the rules so we may make a conceptual amendment on the Dash One Amendment for Senate Bill 336.
On page 6, line 13.
Page 6, line.
So we do change it from 7 to 5?
No, Mr. Chair, perhaps we have legislative counsel could help us to explain what we should correct it to.
Very good. Well, is there any objection on waiving the rules? Hearing none, the motion carries. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Sorry that we're dealing with this error. I'm going to suggest, if you would, that in line 13, we might want to lose the word subsection 7 of, so that it reads, formally adopted under this section. This section is 195.110. Subsection 5 that's been mentioned describes the content of the plan, but it does not refer specifically to the idea of adopting the plan. I don't see a section that is explicit in terms of saying formally adopted under some particular subsection. There is actually a provision in subsection 9. This section generally applies to large school districts. There is a provision in subsection 9 which would allow other school districts to formally adopt as well. So I think the best reference here to catch all of the school districts that can adopt under this section is to just refer to the section broadly.
This full section.
So it is appropriate, Mr. Chair, for me to put that in the amendment?
If you have a bill,
I believe, and I'm going to watch Harrison when I do this, we're going to delete the word section, the number 7 in parentheses, and the word of.
Subsection.
So we move
subsection. Pardon me.
Subsection.
Move subsection, 7, and of.
Mr. Chair, members, so that sub B would then read, the lack of school capacity is based on a school facility plan formally adopted under this section.
Right. And.
Very good.
Yep. Got it. Any further discussion?
So, Mr. Chair, we're deleting just the word subsection.
And the number and the word of.
And of.
And end of. Okay.
Further discussion? Any objections to the conceptual amendment? Hearing none, so amended.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash One Amendment as amended to Senate Bill 336.
Vice Chair Dahlem has moved the Dash One Amendment as amended to Senate Bill 336. Further discussion? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for my lateness. Could you confirm for me, does LCDC on board now, the homeowners or home builders, everyone's on board with this Dash One?
We have everybody on board. The home builders were here, and they had worked hand in hand with all parties.
Okay, and we heard from the cities or the counties. Okay,
we have not heard from the League of Oregon, the Association of Oregon Counties on this.
We're from the cities.
And Mr. Chair, we also heard from Stanford Children, who supports the amendment.
I've asked, Mr. Chair, this is obviously affects my district. And I've asked the superintendents, have not heard yet, so I'll be willing to give a courtesy yes if there's any problems they have. We can maybe try to get it into the Senate before it goes back.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? We are on the Dash One Amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Any objection to Dash One Amendments? Hearing none, so amended. Vice Chair Dahlem.
I move Senate Bill 336 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Dahlem has moved Senate Bill 336 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion? Hearing none, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Quinn.
Aye.
Representative
Dillon.
Aye.
Representative
Greenlick.
Aye.
Representative
Com.
Aye.
Representative
Crummel.
Excused.
Representative Lynn.
Aye.
Representative
Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Buckley.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Greenlick, would you be kind enough to take this bill to the floor for us?
I'm delighted.
I appreciate that. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 336 and move to the top of our agenda, And we'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 199. Mr. Olson, when you're ready to, could you fill us in on this Senate bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 199 eliminates student loan default statutes, eliminates student loan guarantee fund used to guarantee loans made by eligible lending institution, eliminates the Volunteers in Service to Oregon VISTO program, declares emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2007. Mr. Chair, this comes at the request of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I believe we have the Executive Director to testify on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Johnson, wonderful to see you as always. And I hope your budget is doing well in those other hearings.
Doing well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dennis Johnson with the Student Assistance Commission. And this bill recognizes changing reality, I guess, in two important ways. First of all, it eliminates our enabling language for the Guaranteed Student Loan Program, what is now known as the Federal Family Education Loan Program. OSAC, the Student Assistance Commission, officially exited that program at the end of 2004, so it predates me. But lots of information has surfaced since, of course, and you may be reading about student loan scandals around the country, about incentives that private organizations have made to campuses. There are college and university administrators who've actually gotten in trouble for some of the incentives. And not everything in the free market works to the benefit of the consumer, it seems. At any rate, this is no longer something we have to worry about. We've been spared that scandal in the state of Oregon, and don't have that rancor, and I guess we need to credit Representative Clem for helping the state exit a situation where it would have been very difficult to compete into any indefinite future. So that recognizes the reality. We're no longer in it. We no longer need that language in statute. Similarly, removing language from statute that enabled the Volunteers in Service to Oregon program. This is kind of a bittersweet omission because the program had such wonderful goals and did, in a very idealistic way, encourage and foster and reward community service. Now, this predates a lot of the community service programs that are now in secondary schools, colleges, and universities around the state. We at OSAC have many scholarships that actually reward students for community service. So perhaps this program served as a bit of a catalyst, but we certainly have active AmeriCorps and other organizations around the state. I'm not saying that the need is always being met. It was certainly a laudable program. It hasn't been funded since the early 90s. It came into existence about 6 years before that in the late 80s. So it's recognizing reality again, and that's really, I could have gotten away with just saying whatever Mr. Olson did, but I thought it would be worthwhile for you to be aware of those facts.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The questions? Representative Grinnick.
Has there been any effort to fund this stuff? One way is to get rid of it, the other way is to try to fund it.
Representative Grinnick, Mr. Chair, I have not heard of any. No effort has come up in this session, to my knowledge.
Representative Clem?
In the, let's see, 103-05 sessions that I was on OSAC or chair of it, I've never even heard of the program actually come up in legislative dialogue at all. I knew it was somewhere in our statutes, but never heard of anybody interested in making a proposal on funding.
Thank you.
That takes us back into the 90s, at least.
Representative Lim.
Thank you. Well, why do we need to eliminate of this program? It might be useful for some time in the future when we have money to fund it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, if you're talking about the Volunteers in Service to Oregon program, it is it's complicated to administer. I can see why it didn't continue for many sessions. The program operated by providing vouchers to students who completed community service. They could then redeem those vouchers, which were worth very little, $35 to $50 or so, on a college campus later after they enrolled. Someone has to keep track of all of those vouchers issued and redeemed, and it created a part of a job, or it was somebody's responsibility, I'm sure, back at our agency. I'm not saying that just administrative burdens are a good reason to eliminate a program, but I think in the intervening years, we've seen that other things have arisen to meet that need. So my argument or my response would be the statute should not be full of inactive programs, and this one, if it had only been a few years, perhaps it should be allowed to stay for just that very reason to test it. But since it has been so long, I feel otherwise, and that's why we recommend its elimination.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for coming forward today.
Thank you.
Mr. Russell, is there anyone else who wishes to wish to testify on this bill?
No further witnesses.
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Dolan.
I move Senate Bill 199 to the House floor for the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Dolan has moved Senate Bill 199 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Roblin.
We found our perfect bill. No amendments. Hasn't been amended.
It's fine right here.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Representative Clem.
Just, if I might just take a moment, on the loan program part, this was something, it's probably the hardest thing I've had to do in my whole life. I just one day got contacted by the exec director and said, we're pretty much going out of business, and about 75 or 80 people are going to lose their jobs in the next month or 2 months. These are people who've worked at the agency for 20 or 30 years. And this was back in, I think it was in about 03. And I wasn't comfortable that was, you know, was that absolutely necessary? We went through a long process. We got the DAS auditing sort of function, decided that, yes, in fact, it was necessary. We were able to make some changes and stretch the process out to try and mitigate the damage on people's lives as best we could, make sure that the students wouldn't be left in the lurch. And, I mean, I remember spending 30 hours a week for probably 4 or 5 months on this loan program exit. And eventually 95 or 98%, all but 3 people we found other work for before the layoff or before the program was actually closed. And a few people did were unable to find work for whatever reason, went on unemployment, something like that. But it was a changing reality that really started in the early 90s when we went to more of a federal direct lending program and student loans on most of our campuses. OSAC had done an admirable job for decades of being the loan guarantor prior to having that kind of system, and a lot of good people worked really hard making sure that student loans were available through the agency, and this is sort of the final flowers on the grave. I mean, it really was over in 04, but it was a process where roughly 50 different stakeholders participated in a work group. And the thing I really want to just highlight is what they said was, yes, it's time to get out of the loan business. And so, yes, you're going to have to lay off 70 or 85 career employees. But what we want to see come out of this is OSAC itself strengthened in its ability to provide scholarships and grants and assistance to people that are non-loan based. Because in the end, that's what we all would like anyway. And so now what I see is, you know, 3 years later, I see the Aspire program on the verge of getting its first ever funding. I see this legislature deciding that the child care block grant program would be better suited at OSAC since it specializes in student needs than at the agency it's at. I see a 85% increase in the Oregon Opportunity Grant funds by this legislature. And so the vision that stakeholder group called for, which was don't throw out the entire agency and its mission just because the loan program's going away, has really paid off. And Cliff Trow was the chair of that work group, and he's not here obviously today, but he deserves a lot of credit because it was pretty rough. And a lot of people that are in this room were involved, and it was a heartbreaker. I rest in peace and happy to support the bill.
Thank you. Further discussion?
That was when your first kid learns how to drive.
Hearing none, besides Representative Greenick's comments, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Clem? Aye.
Representative Greenick?
Aye.
Representative Kremel?
Excused.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative
Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Buckley? Aye. The motion carries. Members, I would suggest a consent calendar unless Representative Clem had a desire to.
That was my one speech on the topic. I got in me.
It's very nice. Nice, nice.
Consent calendar.
Representative Clem moves the consent calendar without objection. We will send that to the consent calendar. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 199 and open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 779A. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 779A directs the State Board of Education to adopt by rule the process the school district must follow to resolve complaints, specifies requirements for the process, allows a person to appeal district decision to the Superintendent of Public Instruction, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2007. We have two witnesses. Would you like me to call them, Mr. Chair?
Please, Mr. Olson.
We have Margaret DeLacy and John Love.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. I'm happy to be here again talking with you for the record. My name is Margaret DeLacy. I live in Portland, and I'm here on my own behalf and not on behalf of OTAG or any other organization. I requested that Senator Walker write this bill. The reason I did was that in 1997, I was one of a group of parents who filed the TAG complaint against Portland Public Schools. It was a rather large complaint. We handed in a notebook to document the problems that were existing in the school district. You know, one of those big, fat notebooks. And one piece of our complaint, we complained about a lack of instruction to children and a couple of other items, but one piece was that the district had not, in fact, responded to our complaints as was required by its own written complaint procedure. I, in fact, had been involved in the complaint process for 3 years before we filed to the Secretary of State. This is a process that under our district complaint procedure should probably have taken about a month to complete. Those 3 years, I believe one of my children went through all the way through middle school, and our problems with the school were never resolved. And we complained that the district had simply violated its own written procedures. It did not respond to complaints. We just simply didn't get answers. They would sit on it for months on end. The state refused to consider that part of our complaint. The letter that they sent to us said, policies and procedures regarding communication and timelines for resolution of complaints are matters of district policy and are not mandated by state law. In other words, districts have to have complaint procedures by state law, but they didn't have to follow them by state law. I have to tell you that if my district had followed its complaint procedure properly, I probably wouldn't be here today. The district would have resolved my personal problems much earlier in the process. I would not have had to work my way up to the higher levels of administration and then been frustrated there, and I probably never would have become involved with OTAG and tried to change things on a higher level. I was somewhat upset to learn from other parents as a result of publicity over the litigation on this case that they were having similar problems getting their complaints addressed by districts. Nina Bell, who I believe may have sent you some written testimony, she said she was. She she testified with us in the Senate hearing, filed a complaint concerning major Division 22 issues with her school, including inadequate instructional hours, lack of instruction in PE, and lack of instruction in health. She filed those complaints in the beginning of October of this year, referring to violations that had occurred in the previous year, and as far as I know, her complaint is still unresolved today, even though the district policy should have resolved it again early in the year so that these children would have received appropriate instruction for the course of the year. They've now been 2 years receiving instruction that is in direct violation of Division 22 standards. So I asked Senator Walker to write this bill. Senator Walker, after hearing all the testimony, asked us to sit in a work committee We met with the COSA and OSBA and the state in the work committee, the result of which was that we amended the bill to direct the state to write Oregon administrative rules that would handle this contingency. I believe they're in the process of doing so. Unfortunately, they failed to share the rules with us when they'd written them, and I believe the hearing is right now. It's this afternoon at 2 o'clock across the street. We did send in written comments on the rules. We're not completely satisfied with the rules. There are some drafting issues with the rules. The intent we're happy with. And I would just urge you to pass this bill and make sure that the process continues on its road. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I think I'll let John speak first.
Thank you. That would be very good.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the House Committee on Education. For the record, my name is John Love, and I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon. I've come to speak in support of Senate Bill 779A. The decision to file a complaint with a school district is not one that is made lightly. It is far from an easy process and would be discouraging for most parents. Often this decision is made after numerous attempts have been made by parents to work with the school district in order to improve and right the situation for those immediately affected and for similar individuals throughout our state. This road can often be frustrating and can take an emotional toll, so a good support system is required for those who file a complaint. Fortunately, a group of parents came together to file our complaints. We have a core group who work collaboratively. As a result of this process, our friendships have grown and we have become stronger. Our kids have become stronger, too. These are positive results of this difficult work. As parents, we have chosen to model gracious advocacy to and for our children so they, in turn, will do this for others. We weigh the issues and we ask, will this help in the education of our students and students like them throughout Oregon? By filing complaints, parents often take a big, brave step and hope that someone will actively listen and respond appropriately in a timely manner. Senate Bill 779, with its amendments, establishes much-needed guidelines and calls for a process to be established in writing for the prompt resolution of a complaint. As a parent and citizen of Oregon, I hope that we can reach this important goal for all, but especially for Oregon students. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions? Representative Roblin?
So, it just shocks me that the courts agreed with the districts with regard to they had a requirement to do a rule, but they didn't have to do the rule or follow it.
Representative Buckley, Chair Buckley, and Representative Roblin, that piece never, we never took that piece to court.
Okay.
But I've never had anybody disagree with me that that's the way the law worked.
Vice Chair Cobb.
This is for Margaret. And Margaret, as a parent that had one of my children's rights violated at one time, in the school district in which they were attending, when I went to file a complaint, they didn't even have a form. But I really appreciate what you're attempting to do here, and that we need some consistency in many areas. And my only question is did you give input about the timelines? I briefly ran over the scan these up, the OARs, and what kind of input have you given to the process of timelines?
Representative Comp, John might want to address this also. Portland has a relatively prompt process. There are three levels, and each one has a turnaround of about a week to 10 days.
Okay.
However, Salem, on the other hand, has what I can only describe as a Byzantine process, which this group of parents have been working their way through. We initially suggested 90 days for a complaint to be heard beginning to end within the district. Mm-hmm. At that point, if it is a Division 22 complaint,
right,
and only if it is a Division 22 complaint, the complaint is deemed denied by the district, and the parent has the right to take that complaint to the state superintendent. The reason that this has happened is often districts don't answer. And the state has taken the position that if a district simply doesn't answer, they can't address the complaint.
Okay.
So it goes into limbo, and it can remain there for quite a while, which is, you know, it's very difficult for parents to file complaints. They don't enjoy the process.
Oh.
And you know, having it not drag on forever is not in anybody's interest, I don't think. The OARs are in process right now, and I can't tell you exactly what they will look like, but that's the kind of deadline that we're thinking about.
Oh.
And I would also like to add that we are only talking about appealing Division 22
right.
complaints or similar state standards to the Secretary of State. We had some testimony in front of the Senate, people coming in and saying, well, what about, you know, Secretary would have to deal with dirty lockers or school bus stops, and those are not included in the appeal process.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Greenick?
Yes, sir. Can the school boards weigh in on this?
They have as an organization. That is, I believe that both COSA and OSBA participated in the work group.
Are they supporting the bill?
They have not opposed it, and they, you know, the last time I heard from the OARs, they were pretty much in agreement. So I haven't gone back and asked them specifically, you know, would you come and testify in support of this? I don't see them here today, so my assumption is that they wouldn't object.
You know, the Portland School District objects to it.
I have not heard any objections from Portland School District. As I say, Portland's existing process is relatively, their written complaint procedure is actually relatively quick. The problem we have with Portland is they haven't been following their complaint procedure. And I have a hard time imagining that a district would come in and say, well, we should be allowed to ignore our own written procedures. I just can't see them testifying to that.
Well, Mr. Chair,
this
is a very serious allegation. I'm not sure what you mean by I don't see as unlikely either that a school district will ignore their own procedure.
Representative Greenlick, if I may read from my written testimony here. District procedures required region directors, they're our next level down from the superintendent, to respond to written complaints within 7 days. A letter we sent to a region director on June 5, 1995, was answered on August 23rd, and I have all of these letters if you would like to review them. The appeal to the district superintendent was written on October 18, 1996. He did not send a written response until January 8, 1997, which was 82 days later. I sent my first written complaint to my school on March 31st, 1994. That was to the principal level. The full extent of the district process was not concluded until that letter from the superintendent was received. It was dated January 8th, 1997, 3 years later.
These events were all 10 years old, is that?
These events, in 1997, we then appealed to the Secretary of State. But Nina has been through exactly the same process, except Nina Bell is another Portland parent, and you should have a copy of her written comments before you. I don't know if you've received them yet.
No.
She has been going through that process this year. They complained in October. The district basically agreed with her concerns in about 2-3 weeks ago. So it has taken the full stretch of this year to resolve her issues with lack of instructional hours, for example, which it should not take a year to find out whether a school is teaching enough instructional hours. You know, you just call the principal and ask him, basically. So, I, you know, honestly, Representative Greenlake, I don't make allegations that I can't support. I've been through a court process, and I would be very happy to provide documentation if you'd like to see some.
Your allegations are 10 years old.
Well, if you wish, I can certainly have Nina send you her records of what's happened to her complaint this year if you'd like it.
And in your complaint, if this bill had been in force, they didn't respond. It actually sounded like they did do the first response in the 45 days.
What, I don't know where 45 days comes in. What I'm saying is that we have a written opinion from the Oregon Department of Education that even though school districts are required to have written complaint procedures, they are not required to follow those complaint procedures, and the department will not enforce the complaint procedure if a parent complains that a district has not followed its complaint procedures, as we are now. We are trying to get into statute and into rule a a rule that says that a district has to follow its complaint procedures. That's all we're asking for today. We're not complaining that a given district has not followed its procedures. We are simply saying that for the future there should be a rule that says that they have to.
Representative Lim.
Thank you. In your letter prepared, given to us, and the first page, a complaint was filed in 1993. It's 10 years.
That's correct.
That
and we are still, that complaint has still not been resolved.
And can I ask if we have time, what's the nature of the attack complaint?
Okay. In 1997, we complained that the district was not, we complained of three things, I believe. We complained that the district was not following the law with regard to notice to parents. Parents have a right to appeal under the law, and they were not being notified of that right or their right to give input to the district concerning services to be provided to their children. The second piece of the complaint was undue delays by the district in addressing our concerns, and that's the part I'm here talking to you about today. And the third was a lack of appropriate instruction for our children at their rate and level of learning. The district subsequently did make efforts to improve its notification processes, its paperwork for parents. And at this point, we feel it's, we've heard a lot of concerns about it. I've been attending parent meetings this month. It may be time to look at that again, but at the time, they did improve them significantly. The state throughout our complaint that the district hadn't been following its own complaint procedures because they said there's no state law that says they have to. The third piece, the state came and investigated. Actually, they investigated both the parent notification and the services. They found the district to be out of compliance. They wrote a compliance order to the district. They said they would come back again. There was a long delay, but they did come back again. They investigated a second time, and the second time they also found the district to be out of compliance. Then instead of suspending some of the state basic school support, which they should have, they said they would come back a third time. They wrote another compliance order. The third time they did not complete an investigation. They relied on information provided by a contractor who had been hired for the district. At that point, we took the district to court, and we obtained a circuit court order in 2004. We are still trying to get that circuit court order implemented by the Department of Education. They are carrying out an investigation right now. Meetings have been taking place this month. It's, you know, 3 years after the circuit court order, which was supposed to be 90 days, but that's what happens. We do not believe that the investigation meets the requirements of the circuit court order, and there's a good chance we'll be back in court again discussing that later this year.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
The complaint made to the principal or the school board, or where did you make the complaint to?
Representative Lim, over the 3 years between 1994 and 1997, I and the other parents complained at many different levels. We started with our teachers. We filed formal complaints with our principals. We complained, we had meetings with the region director who was responsible for a group of schools. We met with the TAG office. We wrote to the district superintendent, and he sent us back a letter saying he didn't really intend to enforce the TAG mandate. And that is when we applied to the superintendent for public instruction. He said, as I recall, and I could give you a copy of his letter if you're interested, that the TAG staff had better things to do than act as policemen.
Just to make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
Instead of a complaint, this looks like a request in compliance.
That's correct.
Yes.
And TAG is one of the Division 22 standards.
Yes. And also, I'm not sure whether school is totally responsible. Maybe legislators might be responsible not giving the school enough funding, for instance, a TAG program. You know, I'm not sure we need to research on that, but we need to check it out, the whole picture, not just the school district alone. That's my comment.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dolan.
Yes, after following this a bit, and the Division 22 concern is appropriate implementation of the TAG statute. Is that in the courts right now? Is the procedure for implementing the... It is in the courts, and it's unresolved in the courts right now?
Representative Dallum, we went to court to tell the department that they needed to enforce that they needed to do a proper investigation of Portland. And the issue that's in litigation right now is between us and the department. The circuit court ordered them to carry out an investigation using a contractor with training and experience. We don't believe that the department has done that, but in any case, the department filed a stay pending appeal. And we are still, I believe, I haven't talked to my attorney in the past couple of days, we are still waiting for the issues raised by the stay and appeal to be resolved. It has been a mess, to be honest, and it has been 10 years since we filed with the Superintendent of Public Instruction. And in those 10 years, according to the parent meetings I attended this month, a very large number of Portland TAG children have not been receiving appropriate services.
Representative Wilburn.
Short question. You indicated that they're currently doing the rules, for administrative rules.
The department is currently drafting OARs to require districts to follow their own complaint procedures and permit parents to appeal if the district fails to respond to their complaints.
So follow up?
Yes.
So they have the authority to do what this bill is telling them to do, and they're doing it?
They have the authority to do with what this bill is telling them to do, yes, and they have for many years.
And they are, but currently they are in the process of doing it?
Currently they are in the process of doing it. I'm not totally confident about the outcome at this point, which is why I'm still here advocating for the bill. We would really like to see this in statute that districts have to follow their own procedures. Senator Walker referred to this as a trust issue, and I'm sorry to say that there is at this point a trust issue.
President Wilburn?
I guess what I'm hearing is that this bill is basically just telling them what they already had the authority to do and what they are currently doing, and it makes me a little less interested. But I understand what you're saying too with the trust issue, but that makes it harder for me. So.
Thank you, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there, Margaret, thanks for bringing this forward. Is there anything in here about delaying? Because that seems to be, at least with the Westland Wilsonville School District, that seems to be their primary tactic, is to just delay. And I wouldn't say they don't answer, but they just delay any kind of action.
Representative Crummell, after we testified the first time on this bill, department came to us with their proposed rules, which they had not shown to us before. And the rules, what the rules do is that they say in the case of a Section 22 complaint, a failure by the district to address the complaint within a certain amount of time is deemed to be a denial of that complaint. And if it's a Section Division 22 complaint, the parent can then go on and appeal to the state superintendent. I have a copy of the OARs with my comments if you would like to see them.
I
think there are some drafting issues with the OARs, which is what concerns me since they're being heard today. But on the whole, we would just like to ensure that this process stays on track. Would you like me to? I can just hand them to
well,
you.
Well, is that what we got here? Is it?
Yes.
Department of Education 581022.
The department decided to draft two OARs and not just one, which has kind of confused the process. They've drafted a new 1940 and a new. I'm sorry. They have revised 1940 and they've drafted a new 1941.
Clarification from Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 582-22-1940 is what exists right now.
That's
so
correct.
I just pulled this off the website and thought it would be helpful for committee members.
Thank you, sir. Okay. That's what I was wondering, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenlick.
Could you help me a bit? Can you tell me what subsection C means?
Subsection C of the amended bill?
Section A, yes. Section A. Subsection C. Recognize that if a district does not provide a written decision within a specified time, failure to provide such a decision will be regarded as the district's final decision.
That is the timeline. In other words, if a district sits on a complaint and fails to address it at all, after a certain number of days, that failure to address the bill is deemed to be a denial. and if it's a Division 22 standard complaint or equivalent, because they're not all in Division 22, the parent can then go on and appeal that decision to the Secretary of State as if the district had denied the complaint.
If I can intervene here, that really is the centerpiece of what you're trying to do here.
That's exactly correct.
Is to make sure there is a final point that the district has, you know, the district has said it would specify up to this point. They haven't, then the parent has the right to appeal.
Representative Buckley, in the case of state standards, that is correct. That's what the goal of the bill is.
And the, if I may follow, you said that the consequence for not doing this would then be the denial of state funds for the district?
Representative Greenlick, the existing state statutes and OARs set out a process for appeals to the state superintendent concerning state standards. There is a process that the state superintendent goes through when a complaint is made that a district is failing, for example, to teach math or has closed early for the year. The process involves the state coming in and investigating the allegation, verifying the allegation, and writing a compliance order that gives the district a certain amount of time to come into compliance. The district is then given an opportunity to respond and to write its plan for coming into compliance. It must write that plan. The district then comes back and verifies that the district has followed a plan for coming into compliance. And at that point, if the district is still has not met the requirements for its piece of that, the state has the opportunity to withhold all or part of the state basic school support. I can't quote you the exact law right now, but I think probably Representative Dowell calls what it is. The state superintendent does not have to withhold all state basic school support. They could withhold a dollar. It's at the option of the state superintendent how much money would be withheld. But I think the intent of the law is that if a school district is totally thumbing its nose at the law, for example, it closed school in January, that the tax dollars that are going to those students should not be spent in providing them with an education that's not happening.
That's not the kind of complaint you're talking about, that school closed in January.
That is included in Division 22. Instructional hours, instruction in academic subjects. I believe that PE and health and certain academic areas are all included in Division 22, and the TAG mandate is one of those 22 standards. But these are the standards that the state has decided it will require its schools to provide appropriate education for every Oregon student. This is not just a TAG issue.
Representative Clem.
I had a question. I thought that I heard somewhere in that one of these last answers, the Secretary of State is a superintendent of public instruction.
Okay,
I was going to say, you could be waiting a year for the results of the
Secretary of State. He's not too speedy either, I don't. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Cramble.
I would point out that this is also an issue for students that are on individualized education plans and students that are falling under IDEA. That's been my experience, and when I mentioned Westland Wilsonville Schools, that's been my experience with them, and I've got several parents that have called me and asked me to try to intervene, which, of course, the school district tells me to go,
Go away.
Yeah, I won't say what they tell me to do. And so it's viewed as being a local issue in that respect. But the problem is that and their tactic has been just simply to delay. They just don't make a decision. And so consequently, I have one parent in particular in Wilsonville that has spent her son has Asperger's disease, and she has spent the better part of the years that he has been in school, which I think he's now a senior, trying to get the appropriate services for him through the school district, and has gotten nowhere. So I'm very glad to see this kind of a bill come forward, because I think we do need to make sure that the districts understand and that the state understands that this is a very serious issue, and that these districts need to have the process, number one, and number two, they need to follow their process. And if they're not going to be following their process, then there needs to be some ramifications.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, if I just could clarify a little bit.
Short answer, please.
I'll keep it real short. IDEA is a federal law.
That's right. Well,
and a lot of the process that takes place under IDEA is federal process.
Correct.
What we're talking about is enforcing state laws. And, in fact, our experience has been that the department seems to take enforcing state laws a little bit less seriously than it does enforcing federal laws, because the penalties are much slighter. So I don't know if that would solve the problems with some of these special ed issues.
I think it would.
Okay.
But at least in terms of communication.
In terms of the state process.
I do understand that. Further discussion, further questions? Representative Donald?
There's a couple of things that trouble me here. One, no one should be denied due process.
Right.
Either justice delayed is justice denied, but we have two different items on the board, and let's take the one with curriculum. And I know of schools, when we do this, we have small schools. I testified in front of you that are making Sophie's Choice when it comes to curriculum. The reason that they're making those choices is because there's not enough money off of the curriculum. So we go through the entire process, and the penalty is to take money away from them. Whatever money we take from them would then set them up for a complaint for the next piece of curriculum that was gone. So I understand the process, but I also wonder, if you are in court, are we not going to get out of the court decision a process that must be followed?
Chair Buckley, Representative Dallum, first of all, the financial issues are included in the state appeal statute, so that a small school that was unable to meet a Division 22 standard because of financial issues, I believe, has the right to make that argument to the state superintendent and have it considered. We do not believe that the issue that with TAG is a financial issue. I have been here advocating for funding. We need funding, but we believe the districts could do a much better job with what they have than they've been doing, and part of the reason is the enforcement issue, that nobody has held their feet to the fire and told them that they need to do it. And I believe you had a second question you asked about the process issues.
Whether the courts would be...
Courts be handing us... At the completion, when you finally resolve your issue, will we have not then set up a procedure for complaint?
Representative Dallum, Chair Buckley, I don't believe that could possibly come out of the court. I can't see a judge wanting to take over a school district and telling it what to do. We only asked the court to rule on whether the department had carried out a proper investigation when it did so. And whether it was right for them to rely on information that was provided by somebody who'd been hired by the district. And that is still the only issue that is before the court. I believe that the question of how due process should work is a proper question for the districts and the legislature, and not one for the courts. And I don't think judges have any interest in taking that responsibility on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And any further questions for these witnesses? Thank you so much for coming forward. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any further witnesses on this bill? Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill?
Chair Buckley, I've had a couple of representatives ask for more information. May I give them give your assistant my card, and
certainly,
they can certainly contact me if they want more evidence.
Of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, we are in a work session, and I would entertain a motion on the bill if the committee is so inclined. We will have discussion as well.
Sure. Unless Vice Chair Compa is going to do this,
yes,
I would be happy to There are no amendments.
There are no amendments.
Okay, I would be happy to move Senate Bill 779 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kremel has moved Senate Bill 779A to the floor with a due pass recommendation discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I'm going to oppose this bill. There are school districts like Portland, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand parents. And this is about individual complaints from individual parents of the school board for a variety of things. The superintendent is creating administrative rules to deal with how these complaints need to be handled. That seems to me to be a legitimate thing for them to do. It seems to me us using basically a special purpose bill for enforcing complaints of individual members against the school board, individual parents, or anybody else, I suppose they don't have to be a parent, as somehow to provide extra weight to those complaints seems to me to be a problem. Should the school boards be responding to complaints? Absolutely should be responding to complaints. That's a part of what they do. If you don't like it, then you vote out the school board, or there's a variety of things that you do. There's lots of ways to redress it, but to create a state statute that says the superintendent should do what the superintendent's already planning on doing seems to me to be a kind of an abuse of the legislative authorities in this case.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dolan.
I'm conflicted with this bill, but I'm going to oppose it. And I'm going to oppose it because I don't know of a complaint that has weight, that hasn't brought an issue to district court. It seems in my tenure I got to court once every 3 or 4 years. That's not the way that we want to resolve issues, but I'm reluctant to step in the middle of this one. I know that we went through a time with IDEA that there was a lot of defining, and that took a lot of court issues. And I'm certain that we're going to get some definition here. And I'm reluctant to preempt that process. So I'm going to be opposed to the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you. The bill, what is asking, the school, the State Board of Education shall adopt by rule, rules by requirement. And it is not mandating how to do it, what to do, but that requiring that the rules to make certain progress. So, you know, this looks like a good bill. And then when that the school, that the parents or anyone in the district write to the superintendent or the school district or school board, the principal, they should respond in a timely manner. It takes more than a month and a year. That doesn't justify me. So this looks like a good bill. I'm willing to support it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Robin.
I've decided that I'm going to give it a courtesy yes. I need to consider some other things before it comes to the, if it comes out of here, goes to the floor. What it really says, and I think as a high school principal, I received complaints, and we had a complaint procedure in our district, and it had timelines like respond within 10 days, or it is considered denied, and they move it to the next level. And I think that's the kind of stuff you have to have to put people in the position to make their decision. It's difficult at times for schools to give decisions on things like TAG when they know they don't have the money and they're trying to do what they can. They think they're doing it. They don't want to admit that they're doing as little as they are. But the reality is I have no problem with saying, here's what we're doing. We think it's enough. Sorry, you're denied. That's all they'd have to say. That doesn't mean that they're right or wrong. They can still take that on and go with it. But I think that organizations and schools need to be honest with those people and say to them, here's what we're doing, why we think this is appropriate, and if you don't like that, you can take it to the next level. To not acknowledge at all that it's happening is not an appropriate way of doing it. And I want to talk to some people before the floor vote if it gets through here. But from the standpoint of just reading the bill the way it is basically saying do these, follow these procedures and get to the point where you need to be. So I can support it here. I want to look it over. My biggest concern, the only angst that I have is I don't think we need to have extra laws on the books when we already have the authority. They should be doing this, and it appears that they are doing it. But I haven't seen what they did today, and so this will at least give me the confidence that I can change if they get it taken care of and they do it right. I think maybe we should defeat it on the floor. But I don't know what they've done today, so I'll give it a courtesy yes and then follow through.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Kump?
Thank you, Chair Buckley. My only comment is from a parent's perspective, somewhat with a principal's perspective on the other side, because I do believe that we have a responsibility to our parents and children to do timely actions. But my comment would be is we have an incredibly big department, and I can never get it right, but consumer and business products, that if we have a concern about a product, we have many people that we can go to and help get help with about that product. Our children are the most valued thing that we have. And if we have a concern about our children, whenever I met with a parent when they had a concern, I was always listening as if it was my child. And so this is a reactive bill to maybe overemphasize a point, but I'm willing to recognize it and move it to the next step also.
Thank you, Representative. Without further discussion, would you, Andy, good to see you back. Would you please call the roll?
No, but I want to see your information, Representative Roblin. I may change on the floor.
Representative Greenlight?
No.
Representative
Fox?
Aye.
Representative
Kremel?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Wizna?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kremel, would you like to carry this on the
floor? Sure, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session for Senate Bill 779A. I'm going to open up the work session for Senate Bill 365A. And members, just for your information, Senate Bill 775A, we're going to carry over. We are still waiting on an amendment on that. So we are in a work session for Senate Bill 365A. Mr. Olson, you are? Mr. Olson reminded me that I should designate the time. We're carrying Senate Bill 755A over till tomorrow. We are having a hearing tomorrow on another Senate bill and 775A.
This room?
Yes. Tomorrow is Thursday in this room. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, can you remind us where we are? Yes, we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 365A requires college textbook publishers to provide prospective adopters of a particular textbook or set of textbooks with specified information regarding products. Requires publisher that sells textbook bundles to offer higher education institutions the option of ordering each component of a bundle separately and disclose availability and pricing of separately purchased textbook. We have before us the same amendment that was discussed on the 21st, which is the A5 amendment, which would delete all the whereas clauses, refine the definition of textbook bundle, add to the definition of what textbook bundle does not include, focus the list of textbooks, including supplemental items, to be provided to a subject being taught in a course, delete language regarding the length of time publisher plans to keep the product on the market and replace it with language regarding the year the prior edition of the textbook was published, delete wholesale price and replace it with the price publisher would offer the textbook or components of the textbook bundle to higher education institutions. Add the option of making the list of textbooks, including supplemental items, available by phone, mail, or email. And clarify the option of ordering each component of the textbooks bundle separately also applies to potential adopters of the textbooks. We have also before us, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, an A7 amendment, which came right before the committee meeting, and I've not had time to analyze it. It has some aspects in common and some that are different, and I've read it. That's the best. I think there are proponents who could explain
Mr. Olson,
that.
That's been your most remarkable description. It has some aspects of the same and some that are different.
I was dazzled.
That was very impressive. Members, I would note, and I believe Representative Wisner has brought the A7. I believe the A7 contains many of the written comments that were made by Mr. Gardner when he was previously before us, and it also includes a section on gifts to employees, royalties, etc., honoraria for in this process of textbook purchase.
We are in a work session.
Does the A7 include the A5?
No, it does not. The A8, they would conflict. And just to let you know where I am on this, Representative Greenlick, I'm interested in reading the A5s. Today, it's the closest that the textbook publishers and the proponents of the bill have gotten to. Their differences are in the A7 amendments.
I move the adoption of the A5 amendments.
Representative Greenlick has moved the adoptions of the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 365. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
I'm going to oppose the test 5 amendment.
Please.
And then there should be other inclusions in the bill, such as such as shown in the Senate Minority Report that the no royalties that should be in there, and plus some others. So I'm going to oppose the.
Thank you, Representative. Right now, the A5 does not contain any mention of the text that was in the Senate Minority Report, unless I am mistaken, Ms. Rolls.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that some of the issues that were deleted in the Minority Report are also deleted in the A5, namely the whereas clauses, which were of some dispute. Those have all been deleted, I believe, in both the A5 and the A7. The whereas clauses are deleted. And we did hear testimony that there has been some discussion between the different interested parties, and there have been some compromise on the A5, but they had not achieved consensus on all points.
Representative Wiesent, would you like to help clarify?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think this... I told a young college student out in the foyer this morning that I want to pass a bill to do this and help the students, and I do want to do that, and I think we will. The testimony we heard on this bill is both sides of the issue here have worked hard at trying to come up with some compromising language, and both sides feel they've given to the utmost of their ability to give. Representative Clem and I both, I think it's important if we're going to put all the burden on the university or the business community, that we also have a burden on the professor or the adopter to also have some ethics and be sure that he's not abusing the system and causing undue expenses on our college students. So that's the, as you said, the dash 7 contains that statement. It was in the minority report. It was a bipartisan vote in the Senate. So I think it's, we want to do this for the students, but also we want to be sure that we're not we're correcting all the problems, and it's not always the business community. So I would strongly recommend the Dash 7. I know it has some issues in there that the students, the Oregon Student Association still doesn't like. I really thought that we could maybe put both definitions of the textbook bundles in there, and that way both people have what they want. Would be another compromise or a A8. But that's my reason for introducing the Dash 7s, and I think it's an important bill. I think we want to do it for the students, and I hope we will, but I hope we also be sure that we take care of the ethics issue that Representative Clem and I were concerned about.
Thank you, Representative. I'll let Representative Clem respond as well. My concern on bringing the ethics issue in is that the bill has focused very much on the price of textbooks, and we have not received testimony concerning a problem with the faculty members in the state of Oregon somehow driving up the cost of textbooks due to acceptance of royalties or honoraria. I would like to, my preference would be to keep the focus of the bill on the issue of
the bill doesn't say that they cannot accept royalties. That exempts, they can.
Right. Yes, they can. But I guess the gist of my comments is that we haven't heard testimonies that there is a problem with our faculty and our state behaving unethically in order to somehow deprive the students of fair textbook prices.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Absolutely.
We did hear from our young Zach that I hadn't thought about the issue when he said his professor
hadn't used the book.
Yes, sir.
But again, I cast no aspersions on that professor other than perhaps absent-mindedness, I would hope, would be the Representative Clement, I'll let you respond, and I'll get to Representative Greenland.
There are some things in the A7 that I don't like, and so I'm going to support the A5s. But I do actually have some A6s here, which would get at the ethics thing. I'm afraid, though, because it was kind of a rush deal, that maybe it's not quite as balanced as it came out of LC as I would like. So I'm thinking possibly this isn't the right way to go either. It essentially creates a new crime called the crime of bribing an adopter. It came out as a B-class felony. That's jail time and a $250,000 fine. It's
no problem.
It's if the person is an employee of a publisher of college tech books and the person offers. So it's really on the textbook publisher, and it doesn't have the features for the faculty member. So I think probably we need to not adopt my amendments either, but look at some solution at some other time. It's a little harsh. A little jail time for textbook bribers. So I'm going to vote for the A5s and then work with my friend on maybe something that's a little more balanced.
Representative Clinton, you are the law and order representative.
Another mandatory minimum.
Chair Buckley, thank you. The only comment I would make is I now see why Representative Clem is on education and not judiciary.
Representative Greenlee.
I waste a lot of paper, too, on these things.
Chair, I've taught 40 years at two institutions, almost all that time on a volunteer basis, and I've been involved in scholarly organizations all that time of professors. I've literally never, ever heard of an allegation of what's proposed in 5 subsection 1. I mean, 5 subsection 2 is bad. B is bad enough. 2, where there are clear allegations that a professor will use his own textbook to get royalties and try and convince others to use his textbook. I mean, that seems to be fairly common. But the notion of the allegation in 5.1 is, I literally have never... We heard all sorts of bad things about our colleagues, they're sleeping with their students and a variety of other things.
That
may or may not be true. But the fact is, this is an allegation I've never heard. So to put it into statute, the notion that faculty gets bribed to adopt textbooks just really is, I think, it's bad form.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Usually bad guys, they do behind, so you don't hear much about it.
Ah, you hear.
And so that's just one point. I heard from time to time, I was that the higher education institution is a very, if I could say this, a very holy place to teach our children. But always there are some bad apples. Law is required not for good guys, but for the someone who is not desirable. I think that as I read this minority report, in the section 3, if I may read, it will take about 1 minute. Except as provided in subsection 2 of this section, employee of the higher education institution may not demand or receive any payment, loan, advance, deposit of money, or promise thereof in return for adopting specific course materials required for coursework or institution. An employee of a higher education institution may receive the following: free review course materials, such things, royalty or other compensation from sales of a course material that include the employee's writing or work, honoraria for academic peer review of course materials, training for the use of course materials or course technology. This is nothing wrong with it to include in the dash 5. As long as we adopt that, it's looking fine, but if not, I will continue to oppose it. Dash 5.
That's in the dash 5.
That is in the dash 7.
Those words are in the dash 7.
Is in the dash 7.
That is in the dash 7.
Is in the dash 7?
Yes, so, yes. So I think your preferred amendment would be the dash 7.
Yes, okay. I would go along with the dash 7.
Representative Clement, do you have something else to do?
No, I just was going to offer my friend that the dash 5 plus this dash 6 would really be tough on... I'm just proposing maybe this issue could be dealt with separately because I think there's probably some responsibility on both sides. I tend to actually think that just because maybe we haven't heard of it doesn't mean that it's not good to have an insurance policy. I do think there's something to be done here, but you know, jail time and or, you know, bad insults to professors, I'm not sure either one really gets us there. I would prefer to work on this separately, which was sort of the testimony we had the other day. It was sort of a last-minute thing, and it's something that probably requires more thought.
Thank you, Representative Kim. Representative Greenlick, if I may ask you a question as a member of the faculty of the institutions. If a member of the faculty you worked with had found to accepted money in order to... personally make sure textbooks were put in the classroom, would that be a violation of contracts that you were...
Oh, I think it would be a cause for dismissal.
Thank you, Representative.
The cause for dismissal.
Thank you, Representative.
Can I one more proposal?
Yes.
And since we are going to have an education committee meeting tomorrow, why couldn't we give them one more day, think overnight, and come back tomorrow maybe with a compromise version?
I appreciate that, Representative Lim. I believe the proponents and the publishers and the proponents of the bill have worked strenuously. I think they're a little tired of each other.
I think he gets tired of Jim.
No, I know. He's an extreme pleasant man. I'd be interested in moving the dash 5 in the bill today. I don't think that there are other areas besides the area of ethics, which again, from my understanding from discussions, we pretty much have a black and white view of whether that should be included in this bill. I believe the extra day would be...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I still think, no, the issue is the bundling. I know that was the main issue that the publishers and the student advocates had this... whether there's two different descriptions of what the textbook bundle does not include. And I was not being facetious when I said I thought maybe both of them, if you put them both in there, would that be a possible? Does that work?
Give me a second to read these two description definitions of textbook bundle.
It was the same description as in the minority report.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett.
Why couldn't they both be in there? Because both does not. And then Representative Clem and I next session will be sure we take care of those terrible publishers and professors.
We're going to do this right here, aren't we? We're going to get it.
We got 5 to 10 minutes. What the heck?
Good crew, too.
Looks like about 7.
And I don't have that from either side. I just happened to look at that.
I think it's fairly decent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner for the Association of American Publishers. That would work for us, but let me just be clear what the effect of that would be. There would be essentially two categories of exclusion where there is now one, and it would the two categories would be unusable, which we believe is too drastic for the reasons that I testified about, so that something can be marginally usable but still not comport with the editorial decision to create an integrated product. That would be exclusion number one. Exclusion number two would be our preferred exclusion, which is the integration language that's in the dash 7. So that solution would work for us, but just to be clear, it would incorporate both of those types of exclusions.
I didn't. That suggestion was not coordinated either side.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, Brett Rillette, Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. And I'll be real brief. Our concerns with the new language, if you look at the dash sevens, is that it describes what is not a bundle as an integrated combination of two or more units. And Laura Etherton and myself, we have been in discussions with bookstores as to what they consider to be integrated units. And this was an example that the Willamette bookstore from across the street gave us of what they would consider to be an integrated unit. And this is definitely what we are trying to address with bundling. These are two books that could be sold separately, but when you look at the definitions as an integrated unit, this is what they would see. Our definition does not solely include what would be considered unusable. It also looks at materials that cannot be sold separately due to third-party contractual agreements, custom editions, special editions. So we did try to make it as broad as possible without creating the loopholes that the language in the Dash 7 amendments would do. Another major concern that we have, I would say the two disagreements that we weren't able to compromise on, was that language, and also making the information that faculty are able to receive here.
Bring that one up.
Sorry?
I didn't bring that one up.
Please go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say,
you didn't,
in the Dash 5s, the information is also available to the public, meaning that students that run nonprofit book swaps on campus could request from the publishing companies the same information that the faculty are getting. In the Dash 7s, that was one thing we could not agree on. The publishing companies do not want the public to have access to that information. So that is why we weren't willing to compromise on that. We wanted parents, if they were interested, to be able to get that information, as well as students. Yeah, there were a couple other concerns we had, but... Yeah,
I'm not proposing. I just said that one issue.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, very briefly respond. We have to step back, I think, for a moment and realize that what we're dealing with here is a area that is at the core of protected speech. These are private companies that are publishers. They're like the Oregonian. They're like Harper's Magazine. They are publishers. And that means that what we have been attempting to do in crafting the language that we prefer is to accomplish the objective that I think we all have of transparency, but do it in a way that respects the editorial decision of a private publisher to create a presentation, say in the area of computer science, music appreciation, art appreciation, that in fact integrates both the text, say, of an Adobe guidebook with an exercise in how do you create Adobe. That's a core First Amendment function, and it's an area that the Legislative Council opinion that you have heard about does not address. That opinion simply addresses instructional autonomy by faculty. So that's what we have been in principle trying to do, is to come up with a piece of work that will withstand what could otherwise be an Article 1, Section 8 First Amendment challenge.
Chair,
can I? Really?
Yeah. I'm not going to get into a constitutional law argument with Jim Gardner, but it's not a wise thing to do. But couldn't it be construed that requiring bundling and therefore raising the price restricts, in a sense, the access to the free speech material that the professor is trying to get across in a single book as opposed to two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we agree completely with the proposition that that items that are truly distinct items should be available for sale separately. The question becomes that sort of borderline issue of when is it an integrated whole as opposed to two separate functionally usable items that are and can be used entirely on their own with full functionality. That's really, and it's a line drawing exercise. We've simply tried to do our best to draw that line in a way that we think makes the most sense in terms of both the First Amendment issue, but also the usefulness to the students. And there's honest disagreements about how to write that up.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Representative Klim.
I just want to say that, I appreciate the work that's been done on this. The sort of faculty member knowing the price, to me, is the most important feature of this bill. I think that This bundling issue may be something that we have to look at again at some point. If the line's not in the right place and it becomes impractical, I'd be open to doing that, you know, next time around. Because I know, you know, there's a good faith effort here to see what we can do. And this part is a little tricky. I mean, and I understand the free speech part. So I just wanted to say that. I do appreciate it, and I will not draft amendments to put your employees in jail.
Thank you, Representative Flynn. I'm going to go and ask for a vote on the motion to adopt the dash 5, and I'll do that by roll call. Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Flynn. Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative
Crumble?
Excused.
Representative Lim?
No.
Representative
Rosa?
Aye.
Representative
Wizard?
No.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 7. Since we just had the motion does carry, so it is the bill is amended with the dash 5. No. Representative Wizard?
Call for the vote.
Representative Wisner moves a dash 7 for to Senate Bill 365A. Thank you for the great discussion on it, members. And, can I call for a roll call vote?
Representative Clem?
No.
Representative Dolan?
Aye.
Representative
Greenlight? No.
Representative Cobb?
No.
Representative Crumwell?
Excused.
Representative
Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
No.
Representative Wisner?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
No. I believe it. Okay, thank you. Thanks for verifying. The motion fails. I would take a motion on the bill.
I move.
Representative Greenlight?
I move Senate Bill 365 as amended to the floor with the Democrat recommendation.
Representative Greenlight moves Senate Bill 365A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Brief discussion from anyone? Hearing none. Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Clinton.
Aye. Representative Dollar.
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Excuse.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative
Roblin? Aye. Aye. The motion carries. The chair will carry the bill on the floor because I've had so much fun with it thus far. I'm going to close the work session for Senate Bill 365. We will see each other tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Members, thank you for your work and your attention. We are adjourned.
I want to make a point of order. I want to note, Buckley, today.